This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 27, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Benazir Bhutto is assassinated. We'll hear the latest from Pakistan, plus what her death means for the country's political stability. Mahmoud Abbas and Ehud Olmert meet in Jerusalem to kickstart a stalled peace talk process. And remembering the 35,000 people killed a year ago in Southeast Asia as a result of a massive tsunami. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The assassination of Pakistani opposition leader Benazir Bhutto has sent political shockwaves around the world. The suicide bombing has fueled fears that a peaceful solution to Pakistan's political crisis also died in the blast. Bhutto had been campaigning ahead of next month's elections. We'll have more on the assassination of the former Pakistani prime minister later in the newscast. Mass burial services have been held for about 50 people killed on Christmas Day in a pipeline explosion in Lagos, Nigeria, Semolakoya reports.
The victims, most of whom were burnt beyond recognition, have been given a mass burial. The incident occurred on Christmas Day, exactly 1 year after more than 200 people died in a similar oil pipeline explosion, also in Lagos. Most of the victims in both cases were scooping fuel from a leaking pipeline before it exploded. Although Nigeria is a leading exporter of crude oil, the majority of its people remain poor. Extreme poverty has forced many into the risky practice of scooping petrol from oil pipelines which have been broken by oil thieves. More than 10,000 people have died in pipeline fires in recent years. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Thousands of civilians in the Democratic Republic of Congo have been displaced by an attack launched yesterday by Lord's Resistance Army rebels. Joshua Chilimpa has the story.
The rebels attacked and looted the Kombani Mission Hospital near the Congolese border with Sudan, forcing thousands of terrified civilians to flee for safety. Ugandan officials have condemned the attack as a violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement. The agreement requires the rebels to gather in the designated areas and not to attack civilians. The LRA rebels camp in the Garamba Forest in DRC. The group has carried out a brutal 20-year campaign, which has included the abduction of civilians, rapes, and mutilations. Three LRA leaders have been indicted for war crimes. The government of Uganda has been holding peace talks with LRA representatives in the southern city of Juba in an attempt to end the 20-year-old insurgence. Both parties have accused each other of not being committed to the peace process. The Ugandan and Congolese governments have issued ultimatums to the rebels to either sign a peace agreement by the end of January or face a military offensive. Joshua Chalimpa, FSRN, Kampala.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has approved a new regulation that allows employers to cut back or eliminate health benefits for retirees 65 and older. That's the age that retirees become eligible for coverage under Medicare. The new rule effectively allows former employers to create two categories of retirees with pension benefits, using age as the sole criteria. In Chile, a Mapuche activist sentenced to 10 years in prison for arson attacks on disputed land has been hospitalized after nearly 3 months on hunger strike. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago.
Patricia Troncoso, who began her fast in early October, was taken to the hospital from her jail in the southern city of Angol to treat her deteriorating health. She and three others were found guilty of terrorism for a series of arson attacks on lands claimed by Mapuches but owned by forestry companies. Their first trial ended in a mistrial, while in the second, prosecutors used the testimony of an anonymous hooded witness to get a conviction. The four were charged and sentenced under a set of anti-terrorism laws passed during the Pinochet dictatorship. Efforts to reduce their charges from terrorism to vandalism failed earlier this year after negotiations broke down between the Mapuches, senators, and the government. The Mapuches want prosecutors to stop using the Anti-Terrorist Act. They're also demanding the return of Mapuche lands currently in the hands of forestry companies be returned to Mapuche communities. The government says it's willing to listen and negotiate, but not under pressure. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
This year's drought in the southeastern United States has put 2007 on its way to becoming the driest year on record for the city of Atlanta. But it's a close contest hinging on forecasts for rain in the final days of this year. 1954 holds the top spot since the start of Atlanta's rainfall records, which date back to 1879. The city needs 2.5 inches of rain before the end of the year to keep from breaking the 1954 record. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto was assassinated Thursday following a rally in Rawalpindi. Widespread violence has unleashed across Pakistan following the news. FSRN's Devon Therot Orr reports from Lahore, where major riots have already erupted.
Pakistan is reeling from the news of Bhutto's death caused by an assassin's bullet and additional injuries from a suicide bombing this evening. Bhutto had survived an earlier assassination attempt on October 18th that killed 139 supporters. She had finished speaking at a rally in the garrison city of Rawalpindi outside of Islamabad when she was struck by a bullet in the neck. A bomb also exploded at the rally, killing at least 20 people, mostly security personnel. Bhutto was rushed to the Rawalpindi General Hospital and was pronounced dead at 6:16 p.m. local time. Following news of Bhutto's assassination, rioting, in some cases resulting in more deaths, has spread into many Pakistani cities. Sabir Hayat is a Lahore resident and a business owner.
There's a very large bad reaction happening throughout the whole country. People are coming out on the streets throughout the country. They're being very emotional and passionate about the matter. This is a really sad incident for our country. Not any Pakistani considers it a good thing. Everyone condemns it.
Mourners gathered outside the hospital, unable to believe the news of the death of one of Pakistan's iconic leaders. Bhutto, the daughter of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was the first woman to be elected prime minister of a post-colonial Muslim state. Her father was executed after a widely criticized trial following the Islamist coup of General Zia-ul-Haq in 1979. Bhutto was widely respected even by her political opponents. Shaista Pervez Malik is the senior vice president of the women's wing of Nawaz Sharif's party, the PMLN.
We are just shocked. It is the most shocking news ever, you know, and it's a tragedy for Pakistan because she was a woman, a politician of great stature, you know. It is a national tragedy, we take it, and we are with Pakistan People's Party. We want to show our solidarity. It is too big a tragedy. We can't get over it. We have no words. Actually, we have no words.
Pervez Malik, who is a former member of parliament and the PMLN finance secretary, blamed President Musharraf's government for failing to provide better security to Bhutto.
Well, it has been a very, very sad day for Pakistan. You know, before the assassination, there was some firing on PMLN procession. Mm-hmm. And there were about 6 people killed. When she was so vulnerable, I think the government really failed in providing the necessary, security.
A spokesman from Bhutto's party, Kerem Latif Khosa, called on President Musharraf to step down in light of his government's failure to protect Bhutto.
You see, we have been lodging complaints to the government, so-called government of Pakistan, and the so-called president that there is a security risk and she should be provided proper security. You see, it is a lapse on part of Musharraf and it is a lapse on part of the administration, and I think there is no justification for Musharraf to cling on to power.
Some have accused Bhutto of having an authoritarian streak, pronouncing herself chairwoman for life and suppressing dissent within her own party while promoting the idea of democracy in Pakistan. After her death, many are questioning who will rise to lead the party. Pervez Malik.
Bhutto's legacy is the real strength in the People's Party. And her children are too young to handle that kind of situation. She has lost her brothers. Her husband probably would not be carry that kind of legacy.
But Khosa had no doubts that Bhutto's husband, Azif Ali Zardari, implicated in many corruption cases, would lead the party.
Well, of course, there's no doubt about it because, you see, It is her husband who has sacrificed so much. There is no other person.
There is widespread agreement that parliamentary elections scheduled for January 8th will be postponed, and it is possible that President Musharraf will again declare a state of emergency. Benazir Bhutto was 54. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Devon Terrio Orr reporting from Lahore, Pakistan.
Leaders around the world are mourning Bhutto's assassination today in Rawalpindi. Speaking from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, President Bush offered his condolences to Bhutto's family, friends, and supporters, as well as to the families of the 22 people that were also killed as a result of the suicide bomb blast. Bush condemned what he called a cowardly act by murderous extremists.
Mrs. Bhutto served her nation twice as prime minister, and she knew that her return to Pakistan earlier this year put her life at risk. Yet she refused to allow assassins to dictate the course of her country. We stand with the people of Pakistan in their struggle against the forces of terror and extremism. We urge them to honor Benazir Bhutto's memory by continuing with the democratic process for which she so bravely gave her life.
Bush demanded that those responsible for Bhutto's assassination be brought to justice, but many political analysts say that the United States has a very limited influence over Pakistan. Ambassador Wendy Sherman is a former Clinton administration advisor.
The United States does not have a great deal of leverage where Pakistan is concerned. And at the end of the day, the decisions are going to be made by the Pakistani people and by the leadership of Pakistan and not by the United States.
Bhutto's assassination is being seen as a major blow towards democracy in a country that's trying to move from a military government towards a democratic process. Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf has called for 3 days of mourning, and the former military general who had placed Bhutto under house arrest just last month is being pressured by the international community to establish stability for next month's scheduled parliamentary elections. It remains unclear whether those elections will take place or if they will be postponed. KPFK's Patrick Burke spoke with Benazir Bhutto in 2004. She questioned Pervez Musharraf's sanity and brutality.
I do think that General Musharraf is a brutal dictator. I'm unsure whether he is sane, but I would say he is certainly brutal. And the reasons I would say this is because his domestic policies are aimed at crushing all dissent, whether that dissent comes from political parties like mine. He's been holding my husband hostage from November 4th, 1990. Since he took over, and my husband's behind bars. And at the same time, if somebody writes an article critical to him, the person is stopped at a traffic light and simply beaten up and given summary punishment. Human rights activists are hounded and persecuted. Parliamentarians have the intelligence agencies following them, or they're threatened that they'll be charged with narcotics if they don't switch sides.
In 2004, Bhutto expressed looking forward to returning to Pakistan, but explained that there was little justice back home.
I want to go back to Pakistan. And I'm keen to go back to Pakistan. But in the present circumstances, it's very challenging to do that. And the reason is that we don't have justice in the country. We don't have independent courts. The judges are frightened of the military.
That was Benazir Bhutto speaking with KPFK's Patrick Burke in 2004. Bhutto died at Rawalpindi General Hospital from bullet wounds sustained after a suicide blast. She was 54. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met in West Jerusalem today in an attempt to inject momentum to stalled Palestinian-Israeli peace talks kicked off last month in Annapolis, Maryland. FSRN's Rami Al-Mihari has more.
An Israeli plan to construct new housing units in the Israeli settlement of Haruma, or what Palestinians call Jabal Abu Ghanim, in Jerusalem, was the focal point of a meeting between Abbas and Olmert on Thursday. Such plans have overwhelmed two rounds of talks since the last month's U.S.-sponsored peace summit. Palestinians want an explanation from Israelis to the planned construction before the two sides restart negotiations on core final status issues they committed to discuss in a meeting with U.S. President George W. Bush in November 27. Nabil Amr is a media spokesman of President Abbas.
What is required is a halt of settlements and mobilization of international pressure to make Israel retreat from such devastating action. I believe that the meeting between President Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Olmert will focus on such a demand, and we will continue working until the situation in Gaza returns to normal.
The ruling Hamas party in Gaza, which took over the coastal region in June, branded Abbas-Olmert meetings a waste of time unless Israel refrains from its actions on the ground, which Hamas says are meant to create new effects. According to the U.S.-backed Roadmap Peace Plan of 2003, Israel is obliged to halt all settlement activities on occupied Palestinian lands, including Jerusalem. However, settlement activities have gone unabated, with 440,000 settlers remaining in the West Bank and East Jerusalem settlements. Mikhail Warshinsky is an Israeli political analyst.
Expansion of settlements has never stopped since 1969. At any stage, even during the Oslo process, during what many people call the good old days of Yitzhak Rabin, Har-Homa settlement was built during the peace process, or the so-called peace process. So there was no intention from the Israeli government, any government, to stop or to freeze settlements.
Israeli media is reporting that following today's meeting, Olmert assured Abbas that Israel would refrain from building new settlements. United States Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, however, criticized the Israeli plans to build a new settlement, urged both parties during a phone call yesterday to advance talks, which are expected to reach a settlement before President Bush's term in office comes to an end in January 2009. For Free Speech Radio News, and I am MEMC.org, this is Rami Almighari in Gaza.
Sri Lankan authorities used a tsunami mourning ceremony to repeat a vow to crush Tamil Tiger rebels before conducting peace talks to end the long-running ethnic conflict. The island nation's $3.2 billion post-tsunami reconstruction effort has been dogged by corruption and renewed fighting between Tamil rebels and government troops. FSRN's Pania Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
Indeed, it is the Christmas festival season, but for Sri Lankans, Wednesday was a sad day. They mourned the death of over 35,000 of their brethren, young and old, male and female, who were washed away by giant waves 3 years ago on that black day of 26th December. People observed 2 minutes silence. Special masses and prayers were conducted throughout the country. Mariampilla Joseph is a fisherman. He is the only survivor in his family.
The sea was very quiet that day. We didn't know how it became so violent with giant waves. I lost my wife, daughter, son-in-law, grandchildren, my mother and sister. I lost 17 members in my family. I am all alone now.
Relief officials said in most of the fishing families, the males survived as they were fishing in the sea far away from the beach. Mary Pakisodi had lost 4 children in the tsunami. She survived with her husband and a son. She says she is fed up with the life in the refugee camp.
We want a house. For how long can we live in this refugee camp? There are no facilities here. It's very difficult to live in this small hut. If they give us a house, we'll be all right.
The displaced population complains the implementation of tsunami reconstruction projects is very slow. Officials say identifying proper lands for relocating the displaced families is a difficult task as they have to follow a long legal procedure. The ongoing war between the government troops and the Tamil Tiger rebels also has delayed the reconstruction works. President Mahinda Rajapaksa, speaking at a tsunami anniversary function in Galle, said terrorism would be wiped out as the nation survived the giant waves 3 years ago.
We must remember that without wiping out terrorism, we cannot pave the way for a political solution in the country. We have to push the LTTE to come for a political solution. Without doing that, We cannot talk about peace negotiations. We rose from the massive destruction of the tsunami. Likewise, we will get the best of terrorism.
More than 563,000 people were rendered homeless by the tsunami. More than 10,000 families are still living in refugee camps and temporary sheds. Foreign aid pledges for rebuilding the tsunami devastation topped $3.2 billion. But the government says it had received only $1.2 billion. According to Transparency International, an international watchdog on corruption said, out of the $1.2 billion, only $637 million, less than 20% of the amount pledged, had been spent by the end of November 2007. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
When the New Orleans City Council voted last week to demolish four major public housing projects with 4,500 apartments, dozens of citizens were pepper sprayed and tasered by police who were preventing the public from entering the meeting regarding the demolition plans. The following day, a homeless encampment in Duncan Plaza in front of City Hall was cleared out. Some of the homeless took hotel vouchers, but hundreds of others relocated to freeway underpasses. The two events were seen as defeats for citizens who advocate the right to return for all New Orleans natives, as low wages and the lack of affordable housing already make returning difficult and extremely expensive. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer spoke to former residents of the public housing scheduled for demolition.
What happened at the city council? That was only the beginning, because it don't stop there. It don't stop there.
Before Hurricane Katrina's flooding of New Orleans, Stephanie Mingo lived in the St. Bernard Projects. After the flood, she says it took her 5 hours to get her waterlogged apartment to look decent, and with help from former neighbors, she was able to make her home virtually livable. But Mingo, along with all of her neighbors, hasn't been allowed to move back into the St. Bernard housing units now slated for demolition.
In St. Bernard, people don't treat it like a project as other people see it from the outside. When we was living there, we had plans. We had them put up our own picket fence because this neighbor going to try to outdo this neighbor. This street going to try to outdo that street. So you treat it as a home. That is my neighborhood. That is my history. That's not a project. That is a community.
Mingo currently lives in Iberville, the lone housing project to be reopened in New Orleans since August 2005. She says that with rents more than three times what they were before Katrina, the opening of some 4,500 vacant public housing units would bring down the price of rent. Mingo says that plans to replace the projects with mixed-income housing will make the neighborhood more affluent, more expensive, and will ultimately price out New Orleanians who earn lower wages. Stephanie Mingo's niece, Sherelle, says she's happy to no longer be living in public housing, but asserts that people should have that choice. Spending Christmas Eve at her Aunt Stephanie's house wrapping Christmas presents, she says the life she lived in the St. Bernard Projects until she was 15 was mixed with both good and bad experiences.
If you feel it's best for you to not stay in the projects, and if you could afford to move ahead and not go backwards, then go ahead, take the opportunity while you can. But if you cannot afford to move forward and you have to go backwards and you think you feel that's the best thing for you, then go ahead.
Kali Akuno, an organizer with the Malcolm X grassroots movement, says the recent removal of hundreds of homeless people from the park in front of City Hall was a move to visually cleanse the city center streets for Mardi Gras and several other major tourism events early next year. But with more than 12,000 homeless people already living in the city, many of whom have relocated their camps to underneath a freeway overpass, and tens of thousands of FEMA trailers soon to be removed from the city, Akuno says it will be impossible to hide the reality.
If you're looking at addressing the present crisis and coming up with some sound policies which are based upon democratic input from those who are most affected, then you have no logical reason to, you know, rationalize destroying any property, you know, which is sound, stable, and can withstand a few strong winds and a little flood waters that may come again. That don't make no sense.
Akuno says that despite the city council giving the go-ahead to HUD, he believes they won't tear down any new projects for at least the next 30 days or so, and he thinks there's still a possibility that if the community organizes, two or three of the four housing projects slated for destruction can be saved. He adds that he believes that last week's police tasing and pepper spraying of citizens who were being locked out of a city council meeting will hopefully serve as a wake-up call to some poor and working-class blacks to get involved in the struggle to preserve New Orleans' rich black heritage. The result, if nothing is done, he says, will be a permanent loss of the very culture that makes New Orleans special. For FSRN, from New Orleans, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
On any given day, more than 7,500 juveniles are held in adult jails and prisons across the country. Back in 1974, Congress signed the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Protection Act. Recently, Congress held its first hearing on the act in more than 7 years. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
According to juvenile justice advocates, the current Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Protection Act does not provide adequate protection for minors who are charged with offenses that only apply to children, such as skipping school, running away, breaking curfew, and/or possession or use of alcohol. Because these are nonviolent offenses, the law says these young people cannot be imprisoned with adults or held in any adult detention facility. Over the years, however, critics charge that judges have been using legal loopholes to lock these kids up. Carol Chodoff from the Campaign for Juvenile Justice says this leaves juveniles.
The research shows they would do much better getting needed services. There's probably a reason that Johnny isn't going to school, and that needs to be addressed, and locking him up and throwing away the key is not the answer.
In addition, advocates like Chodoff say the ethnic and racial disparity within the juvenile justice system continues to be a problem.
What we see in the system, the large majority of young people who are incarcerated are African American and Latino youth.
The Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Protection Act currently has disproportionate minority contact written into the legislation. That means the state is required to address racial disparity in their respective juvenile justice systems. But critics say the language does not give states concrete alternatives to locking up a disproportionately higher number of African American and Latino kids. Tani Bush is a caseworker who works with minority youth in Southeast Washington, D.C. She says from the beginning, low-income youth of color don't get the same kind of infrastructural support as other children.
They don't have no recreation centers. People don't come and spend time with them or do things with them because they get discouraged. Once the youth show like they're not involved or they're too a little too rough around the edges, they don't want nothing to do with them.
And even though some kids made some bad choices, Bush says they're still part of their community.
Because at the end of the day, they're children. I don't care what they've done or what's going on with them, they're still a child at heart. And once you get an opportunity to get to know them and they trust you, then you'll see that part of them.
Daquan first entered the juvenile justice system when she was 12 years old. At 17, Daquan is currently out of the system and says she regrets the time that was lost. She now works with other young people and sends them a warning.
And then you be mad, but you can't be mad at nobody but yourself because you don't want to put yourself in this predicament.
Ron Moten is founder of Peaceaholics. He works with youth coming out of the system and says current supports are lacking.
So it's like you take somebody out of a house and then you put them back in the same house in the same situation, but nothing's changed and you expect them to change or you expect them not to do the same things or worse. And that's what we constantly see. We see people making decisions for our children who are not culturally competent or understand our children, and they might be doing what they think is best, but because they don't understand the demographics or understand what's going on in our communities, they make bad decisions that ultimately cause a lot of our children to die, have reoffenses where they're charged with crimes and charged as adults.
Congress will take up reauthorization of the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Protection Act sometime next year. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.